Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Okay, so today I think I was asked to give a talk on the part of the Metta Sutta that says where the monks are straightforward but also gentle in speech. Yeah. So this kind of balance between, you know, I guess it's part of right speech. And it's a balance between presenting thing in a direct way but also in a gentle way. Because sometimes, you know, in the modern society, we have this idea about truth, what truth should be, and that, you know, if someone's a bad cook, you just tell them it's bad, you know, it's a bad food, because they're just being truthful. But a lot of times, I think, you know, truth, being truthful, is used as a way to express your ill will. That, you know, there are ways, the skillful ways to express things, and there are more gentle, kind ways to express things. And when the Buddha talked about speech, he said that truth, or saying, you know, how you feel, is not number one. It's whether the speech is truthful and beneficial to the other person. Obviously, it wasn't truthful, you wouldn't utter it. But it also has to be truthful and beneficial for the other parties. Then you utter it. And the Buddha a lot of times gave, I think, the five factors for you to regarding speech. One is that it's true. It's you have to establish the facts, whether it's true or not. But two, when before you criticize somebody, you also have to establish time and place, whether it's the right time for the other person. Meaning, you know, make sure that they're in the mood to accept your criticism, in a mood to, you know, they're in the space. It's not after they had a, you know, kind of a bad day. They could have just divorced from their a husband, a wife. Somebody's died in the family, they're going through a lot of emotional stress, and then you tell them, oh, by the way, you're late to work, you know, you're late to work, and you didn't do this properly, or whatever, and your fried egg stinks, whatever it is. You have to wait. And also the place, you want to do it privately. You don't want to embarrass a person publicly. You don't want to, you know, call them a public place and say out loud what things that they did wrong, or whatever. So time and place is also important. And establishing the fact. The other one is a few things you have to look at in yourself, that you are motivated for their welfare. That's why you want to bring it up, to criticize, to admonish another person. It's not because they annoy you that you want to tell them off, but actually you want them not to make the same mistakes. You want them to learn from their mistakes. And that's why you're pointing out their shortcomings. It's not that they've been annoying you all week long and then you finally had enough, so you let them have it. No, that's not part of the motivation for saying things to another person. And like this Buddha said, you know, you have to bring up this heart of metta. You have to establish metta in your mind for their welfare, that you're going to say this to them. You're going to criticize them so that they can improve. And I thought that was a kind of a very important aspect of right speech. And the Buddha says, you know, there's other ways where your words should be soft and gentle, pleasing to the ear, like the sound itself. You shouldn't talk too quickly, like I'm doing most of the time. You should, you know, you pace yourself. You should clearly enunciate. And you should talk slowly. But something aspire to, right? Something aspire to. And it's not something that you have to get perfect. And what I feel, like I said, and it's something that is an ongoing process for most of us, of trying to, you know, bring the speech that is straightforward but also gentle. And it's a balancing act. You want to encourage another person but also present the truth, obviously. And sometimes, you know, kind of Buddhist practitioners can err on the side of, you know, being too timid. of not ever bringing up anything that could be controversial, not bringing up anything that could be awkward. And that's also not helping the other person, because you avoid it altogether. Then they don't have an opportunity to reflect, to learn from their mistakes. You avoid it altogether. So I think having lived in a community for many years, and seeing how the monasteries run by different kind of teachers, generally the practice, especially for young monks or people in the beginning of the practice, it's really unless you can say things skillfully, unless you can have metta in mind, not to admonish, not to criticize others around you. Allow the senior monks to do that. That's their job. Your job is to, unless you can improve, unless you can say it from kindness and gentleness, to let it go. So some of my best err on the side of more kind of allowing the other person to kind of discover, to learn from their own mistakes, or allowing more senior members of the community to criticize or to bring anything up that is admonishing another member of the community. But like I said, right speech is something each and every one of us can work with. And it's true, before you say something, just always check, time and place. And it's we talk about this practice of mindfulness, of, caring sensitivity. And that's what, mindfulness is about. Knowing time and place, knowing, trying to suss out and feel how the other person will receive your word. How are they feeling? What does it look like? Look at their body language, trying to engage them in a conversation first, just to gauge their emotional kind of state of mind first before you bring up something that could be, a negative trait in the characteristics. And it's a great way, especially, a great lesson for each and every one of us to work with in the community. But also it's great, obviously, we don't live as hermits. We live in society, we live with family members, we live with other people, we work with other people. So the ability to kind of to use skillful speech, right speech, is a major part of the practice. And it's a way that helps, our mindfulness. And also it's a good cause for harmony, especially, in relationships, husbands and wives, family members, it's a bit more harmonious, and we're a bit more sensitive to the other person, we're more aware, and we're a bit more, have kindness and gentleness when we talk. Sometimes because we're familiar with each other, we could take them for granted, and we can be a bit nasty, we can be a bit mean, and that's not skillful sometimes. Yeah. So, always kind of, before we say something, that's why sometimes the Buddha does, value noble silence or speaking little. Because so much of our speech could be just distraction, a bit of restless energy, just going outwards, and it may not be helpful to the others around us. But like I said, this time and place, sometimes people do go overboard and not say anything at all. And sometimes that's also not helpful, because sometimes, a feedback is always important to other people. So they know whether they're making a mistake. They know, they make it just a little things or whatever. That they're putting, not turn up the light in the toilet, not the end of the world, but yeah, it's good just to mention that. Or leave the water running or whatever. Leaving the shutters down or whatever. Things like that, little things that in the community, it's good to be able to bring that up in a skillful, gentle way. That way, we obviously can learn to live it with each other, but with respect and gentleness and caring. And I find that so much of the Dhamma is not always about, sitting and watching the breath or looking into our own mind. So much of the Dhamma is, the way we interact with each other, the way how we bring up other people's our own defilements or attachment, and we work with it. Yeah, so communal living, you know, and you can see how much care the Buddha put into it. He established a lot of rules around communal living. Rules, you know, how to relate to each other and obviously and in a hierarchical kind of way, but also, you know, from a lot of from sensitivity, from care and compassion. And the rule of dependence, how young monks, you know, should be with always with a teacher the first 5 years. Because so much of our, like I said, our Dhamma practice, so much of our thing, it's, you know, about emulating, it's, you know, on much more of the initial stage of the training, the first 5 years. It's so much on a, so a social level, external level. Because it takes sensitivity. It takes, you know, learning the ropes. How to put in your robes, how to wash your bowl, what is set, how to eat. Those little things you're going to say, well, you know, it's kind of nitty-gritty, nitpicky details. But that helps train in mindfulness. You know, where am I? What am I doing? And is this time? You know, what time is it? What should I be doing? You know, should I be getting setting up the bowl? Should I be, where's my place today? So just, you know, place and time. That way we don't get so caught up in our own head, our own ideas and views. But we're like, we know where our place is in a community. What time it is, when is it time to, you know, eat, to clean up, or is it time to do other things? So that we get so lost in our own kind of agendas that we forget that, you know, what's happening. Yeah, and I find that, you know, in a lot of forced monastery, things, you know, operate in a very kind of quick and efficient way. And so it does take a lot of mindfulness to learn, you know, okay, when you go to a new monastery, it's always a bit of a trick the first 2 days to find out, you know, what are people doing? How do I fit in? How do they eat? How do they walk? How do they, you know, go on rounds around? And what's needed? What's asked? What time they come out to clean? And what stuff do we clean together? And how do we, you know, is it, you know, some monasteries are more chatty and friendly, which is fine. You can kind of fit in. Other monasteries, but more kind of restrained and quiet. And that's it's part of the training to also fit in those monasteries. One is not bad or good, it's just, you know, this ability to be aware of your environment, to not be so caught up in your own stories, in your own dialogue, monologue really, in your head, that you're not aware of, you know, what's happening outside and how to fit in. And it's an important sense of, you know, yeah, fitting in is an important kind of training in kind of communal harmony and humility. You know, we all think the world is the most important thing in the universe. But really, we look around, we know how to fit in. We're just part of, you know, a functioning unit that, you know, each one of us, you know, plays a part, a different part, but also a useful part. And learning to fit in, learning to be useful, learning to be helpful is, I find, yeah, it's very practical Dhamma. Ajahn Chah has always, you know, never talked about so much about the high Dhamma of emptiness, or the jhanas, or stream entry. He's always talking about, you know, the little rules, the little daily things that we do. You know, how you wear your robe, how you take care of your bowls, you know, and how you sit and walk. There's so much of that. And you see, Ajahn Brahm says the same thing, you know. There is interviews that you talk to him. But I says, you know, really, I don't have to talk to you or anybody, to any of the monks, to find out where your meditation is. I just have to look and see how you eat, how you walk, how you move. That's enough. It's, you know, like I said, it's not, it's the same mind that we have, same mind and body that we inhabit throughout the day. It's not a different mind when you sit down. You're not mindful of how you eat, how you walk, how to put on your robe, how to wash your bowl. And it's the same mind you take to your meditation. So, you know, and that's why I wanted to keep, you know, to kind of be aware of that. You know, always, you know, be aware, be careful of what's happening throughout the day. It's not like, okay, now I'm sitting down, now I've got to be aware of my breath now. The rest of the time, just allowing the mind just to drift away in, you know, different fantasies and the different ways, different worlds that we're at. But really, you know, stay in the body and just stay in the present moment. Not, you know, kind of deep, profound, or difficult to understand, but certainly very deep Dhamma, just staying in the body, staying in the present moment. That's the doorway to all wholesome states. That's the doorway to all the more profound, subtle dhammas. You know, in the present moment, how can you understand life? How can you understand your own mind and body? How can you understand the people around you? You're not seeing things clearly in your head most of the time. So, this kind of training and communal living, being present with each other, receiving each other, always act out of kindness and gentleness when you can. And that takes mindfulness. It takes awareness. That takes, you know, sometimes putting yourself, your feelings aside. Yeah, I'm not in a good mood, I'm a little bit annoyed, but never mind, I'm not going to act out of annoyance. I'm going to wait till my annoyance disappears, and then I'll discuss whatever it is that's annoying me. In a way, we, you know, there's not that much heat. And also understanding, you know, in a community, discussing things with other monks or lay practitioners. You know, everybody thinks that they've got the right perspective, everybody thinks they're right. So understand that, allowing that as well. Yeah. To be gentle when you're bringing things up. And also, you know, being a monk or being a junior monk for a few years, you also kind of get better reading people. You better, you know, get more sensitive and understand where people are at. And you offer what is, you know, necessary, what's appropriate at the time. Sometimes you see people aren't open to the teaching, no point trying to convince them. They're not ready just yet. Yeah, and that's the great thing about our tradition, the forest tradition. We don't go out and knock doors on, you know, on door. And say, hello, I'm from the Thai forest tradition. You want to tell how wonderful meditation is? Wonderful, the Buddha, Dhamma, the Sangha. No, you stay here and you practice. And then when people come to the monastery, come to the center, then they're curious, they're open. Then it's also a good time to kind of introduce the teaching of the Buddha to different people. But sometimes people come and they're full of views and opinions. They want to teach you already. And that's interesting. And you also be polite and you can listen. And you know, yeah, there's no point arguing because they're not going to listen. They're not open. And that's fine. You know, people are where they are. They can't be anywhere, you know, anywhere else than they, other than where they are at the present moment. And that's fine. You're polite. But you don't try to kind of stress yourself out trying to, you know, steer them towards right view, what the Buddhist view is, trying to tell them that, you know, whatever, that there are a law of karma and there's other worlds or whatever. People are not ready and that's fine. You accept them where they are and they're curious, then you can, you know, kind of lead them a little bit further. And it takes, you know, a bit of sensitivity, a bit of putting yourself, not what you want, your own agenda, but seeing, okay, what's that person, where are they at? And what's helpful to them. Yeah. And it's a great practice. Always kind of bring you back to the present moment. Bring you back to this being sensitive to what the situation calls for. Not what you want out of the interaction. Or what you need, or what you want, you know, it's just, okay, what's the most skillful things that needs to be done here and now? Like I said, you know, and that's the whole practice, living in a monastery, developing the path, is always inclined towards, you know, wholesome states of mind, and trying to reduce unwholesome states of mind. And I was thinking was that leads to, you know, practice is always about developing, you know, different spiritual qualities. Shantan likes to go talk about the perfection, the spiritual qualities. And you know, some of you know probably a lot of them already. It's, you know, it starts out with dana, the generosity. And the second of the spiritual qualities good to develop is, you know, dana, then sila. This mortal virtue, harmlessness, and then the next one is nekama. Nekama, yeah, it's a renunciation, right? Or another way to look at it is just simplicity. When you, like Ajahn Tan likes to say, when you just come into a monastery and go into a meditation retreat, you're practicing, when you're building up a lot of these spiritual perfections. You know, coming to a monastery, living simple life, taking on the 8 precepts, you're practicing a bit of nekama, a bit of renunciation, not eating in the evening, practicing living simply, not listening to music, and no entertainment, not wearing jewelry or makeup, not indulging in this kind of sexual behaviors. All those are letting go of so much of the world. And it helps to, you know, like just to settle the mind, to stabilize the mind. So, you know, when you think, you know, renunciation is not like, you know, sometimes we think the kind of the kind of evangelical Christians that, you know, oh, if anything is good, anything feels good, must be bad for you. Hopefully this is, and sometimes some of the Buddhists get that as well. If anything is enjoyable, I should renounce it if I want to be enlightened. You know, I should be, you know, kind of very restrained, not enjoying the food, not enjoy conversation, not enjoy anything. Just sit there with a glum face, not talk to anybody. That's renunciation. And I think that sounds, that's a bit overboard, too extreme. Because the path is the path, like I said, of renouncing suffering, the path of renouncing distractions, the path of renouncing kind of things that actually bring more suffering, confusion in this way. And you're actually doing something. Like simplicity is actually something very beautiful, like contentment. And once, you know, you get the hang of it. Yeah, so it's nice to have that extra thing. But whatever we have now is good enough. Yeah, so that way you don't buy into the mind. I was, oh, it would be nice to have this. Be nice to have, be nice to kind of whatever. If the monks can cook their own food, we get whatever we want it. We don't have to eat whatever people bring. Or whatever, you can have your favorite food every day, you can cook for ourselves. Whatever the mind comes up with. But we don't, no, that's not what it, that's not what it's about. It's about just, you know, being happy, content with whatever it is that you're given. That's what the Buddha made, all those rules about, you know, monks not having money, not cooking for themselves, not storing food. It is, and then once you get the hang of it, it's a great blessing not to have to go shopping and go into a store and try to find out, you know, the 20 different types of muesli that you can have in the morning. And, you know, the dozens of type of juice that you can have. And just, it's great. Just take whatever people give you. And it's so much simple. So much simpler that way. Yeah, so it's not about kind of austerity, kind of being, you know, kind of a, what do they call it? A killjoy of, oh, anything's good. I'm not going to take. I'm going to take the worst tasting things, the most bitter food that I can find from the bar, and the most tasteless. I only drink water. I can't drink anything. It's not about that. It's about, you know, kind of giving up the little things, giving up things that not going to bring long-lasting happiness anyway. Yeah, but certainly, like I said, you know, certainly you can enjoy things for what they are, knowing that, yeah, food, sight, sound, smells, taste, they're enjoyable. The Buddha said that if they're not enjoyable, people wouldn't be attached to them. But they don't last very long. So you understand what they are. You give what they are. You rejoice in the wonderful, beautiful food that people bring to the monastery because they put a lot of effort into it. You rejoice in their goodness that they bring. But you also know, yeah, this beautiful taste, they're not going to last forever. It's not going to bring eternal happiness. When you eat it, it's not going to bring you, you know, towards enlightenment. But it's still, you know, enjoy for what it is, knowing that will disappear. All that will, you know, be down our new, spanking new toilet tomorrow. Whatever beautiful food you eat will be just right out there in a couple of days' time. And that's just the nature of these food and taste. It doesn't last very long. Yeah, so renunciation is going to come from a bit of wisdom, this understanding how things work. It's not from sheer willpower of kind of, or not being, you know, negativity of, no, you know, or some kind of an ideal of what practitioner is, or monk should be, or a true practitioner should be, kind of, you know, running away from all those things. And that's why renunciation is a spiritual perfection. And there's different levels that we can work towards. But like I say, it usually aims towards simplicity, aims for, you know, this contentment. That is an aid to meditation. You have a simple mind, you sit down, you're not distracted, but different thoughts that come up. distracted with any kind of desires that comes up. You have a little bit of contentment, desire comes up, you see what it is, you don't buy into those desires, the stories. And that's why it's a help to towards, you know, your spiritual development. One of the other spiritual perfection that comes up, what's the other one, is patience. Patience is always a good one. Buddha praised patience. Kanti is the highest austerity. That's interesting why he said patience and austerity is not the highest austerity you can do. Not fasting, not going without sleep, but Kanti, patient endurance, just the ability just to be with things. Not trying to change it. You know, we all have a sense of self. We all have crave desires from different levels. We also want to get our own way somehow. Yeah, this is the Maharishi routine. Yeah, I know, but I just want to do it my way a little bit. You know, eat at 10. No, I want to eat at 9:30. I want to eat at 10:30. Why can't we eat a bit later? Or whatever that comes up. Oh, I don't want to sit for 5 to 7. I want to sit from 4:30 to 6:30. Or 5:30 or 7:30. Whatever it is that we think or to ourselves when we meet with, you know, certain kind of routines and different ways of doing things. Or when you go into the kitchen or whatever, you have a group working, you want to do your own way and not do it, you know, kind of fit in somehow. And you know, one is normal, that's very, very normal. But two is also kind of sometimes not so conducive to communal harmony, not so conducive to our own practice. So Kanti is his ability to be with things, unpleasant sensation. That comes up, certainly for every one of us, from time to time. Ability just to, you know, to be open to pain, to investigate, to learn, try to deal with them, you know, whatever ways we can. That's why it's very important. And, you know, because we always meet with, you know, things that we don't like from time to time. And this ability is just to, you know, to not react. To not act, to not run away from it, but just try to study to learn it. And that takes time, so that's why patience is important. It takes time for us to kind of learn different things that life is trying to teach us all the time. And so we don't want to look that way. So especially about learning about suffering, learning, you know, from different things, sickness that comes into our existence from time to time. Yeah, so Kanti's beautiful aspect, and it's, yeah. A lot of time, you know, these spiritual qualities, they kind of overlap, and they also nurture each other. So it's not one or the other, or which was the most important one. You know, being Buddhist, without panya must be the one. But it takes patience. It takes a bit of panya to have patience, to understand the law of karma. You understand, yeah, the pain come and go, sickness, you can't have any other way, so you can bear with the sickness. So there's a little bit of panya, wisdom comes out. It says, this is the way things are. You can't change them. So and learn from them, to put up with them. Yeah, so panya is also a spiritual perfection that comes up. And then, what's the other one? There's two different ones that we know is the energy, virya. It's also a spiritual perfection to bring up. And bring up this kind of interest, this kind of a keen sense of, you know, always trying to put forth effort into the practice in a wise way, putting forth effort without, from, you know, willing, from a sense of self, or from using willpower, but putting out forth effort, you know, trying to train the mind, trying to move towards wholesome states, from a sense of devotion, a sense of faith in the Buddha, a sense of gratitude in the teachers, a sense of gratitude to the lay people, you know, who come and feed and support us, want to do something that makes them proud as well. Yeah. So this, you know, putting forth effort is, you know, it is from wholesome desires, not from a sense of, you know, achieving, getting things, but a sense of, yeah, okay, you know, we're a practitioner. We live by the alms of the people around us. So we, you know, our actions should be something that they should be proud of. Yeah, and that's why you see that, you know, with sila, it also comes in the same thing, harmlessness of keeping, not, you know, behaving ourselves in a way that's proper. For a practitioner, for monks to do. We behave in a way that's kind of open-handed. I mean, the Buddha said, you know, what we do in public, what we do, same thing we do in private. We don't try to be deceptive, deceitful, and hide things. And that's, goes to the, that's the other spiritual quality that's also overlapped. It's such a truthfulness, you know, is keeping your word, not deceiving others, and being a practitioner. Yeah, whatever you say, you try to come, become good on your word. Also knowing sometimes, circumstances come up that we cannot fulfill all that we promise. So we're also careful. We don't want to promise that we say that we think that, well, I may not be able to keep as well. So that takes a bit of mindfulness, awareness to navigate the different conditions that come up. And what's the other one? It was adhitana. This is something I think a little bit new. Adhitana is sometimes it's translated like determination, in the Thai they move like making an aspiration as well. Adhitana, like I make an adhitana that for this week, you're not gonna have any sugar. For this week, you're gonna eat everything in your bowl. Different things. It's just a way to train the mind different ways. And it's like I said, it's about training the mind. It's about working with different things, and it's not something that you don't have to so you also understand yourself when you make these determinations. Something that you can keep. Sometimes people make lots of strong determinations, and they don't have the power to keep, and it makes them more obviously disappointed, more sad, more it robs away the self-esteem as well. Sometimes you read in the book, and the Buddha says, "Well, he made determination that he's not going to get up from the Bodhi tree. Let his flesh rot. He's not getting up until he achieved, utter enlightenment, the highest enlightenment." We feel very inspired. Wow, that's great. The Buddha did that. We want to do the same thing, but we have to understand we haven't got the Buddha's spiritual powers just yet. We're just beginning to warm up. So we make this. The goals and determination, something that we can aspire to, the little goals. And also, when we achieve your goals, and it builds a sense of confidence that we can walk this path. Yeah, so we try to, we do. But it takes mindfulness, it takes knowing where you're at in your path. So we work with different kind of challenges. Let's say you're starting out, you can't sit in the puppy position or something, or a chanting, you can't sit up right away. Just make it, try to work on it. Sit a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 5 minutes. Work with, do stretching, work with different kind of muscles in your body. And then over time, you can work up sitting comfortable in half an hour or an hour or whatever. And so it's different ways to work with the practice. Same with, meditation practice, sitting, but, experimenting with your what you think is your limitation, but at the same time respecting that. So when stretch yourself a minute or two, we're not trying to push too much, we're not trying to make this, you've never meditated before, make this huge determination that you're going to sit for 4 hours because you've seen, you read that the Buddha said many hours, and all those Thai meditation masters said, they said from dusk to dawn, not moving, should try that as well. And then, you have to be ready for these things, and those things do happen, but it's from the right conditions, the right time and place, when your practices come together. It doesn't happen because you want it to happen. It doesn't happen because you feel it's a nice, it's a cool thing. It happens, like I said, Buddhism is about causes and condition. Yeah. So when we develop these kind of spiritual qualities, different ways in the mind, we're also knowing. I'm more sensitive to our own present conditions, accepting where we're at, accepting our weakness at this moment, accepting that from time to time we might act out of greed, anger, and irritation. Time to time we might act out of, we're not as energetic as into the practice. That's also fine. Yeah. So just the spiritual qualities, the perfections are kind of a goal, kind of a journey to work for your destination, and then you try to proceed through it gradually, gently, not trying to rush towards the end, not trying to develop, and also knowing where you're at. Yeah, so it's good to these perfections are kind of shooting for the stars, looking where you're at, but also having your feet firmly planted on the ground, drifting off to La La Land, Fairyland. They're drifting off to, you know, reading all the great biographies of the monks and nuns, and then trying to emulate them within your first week of being, in a monastery or whatever. You know, you know where you're at. Yeah, so it's good to kind of aim for the highest, but also with your feet firmly planted on the ground, firmly planted, with your mind firmly planted in the present moment, in reality, and where you're at. Yeah. So these spiritual qualities, perfections, are something we can always practice, no matter where we're at. In the lay world, lots of dealing with lots of different people, dealing with lots of stress and work and family. Kanti is beautiful. Generosity, you know, being able to give to others, being able to be with others, trying to help others in the ways that you can. That's also, you know, beautiful quality to practice. Sila is also very useful. And panya, you know, wisdom is, you know, be able to reflect wisely, reflect on our actions. Is that leading to our welfare, or the welfare of others, or leads to our kind of harm to ourselves and others? There's different ways to reflect on the teaching of the Buddha, different ways to reflect on the Dhamma, different ways to learn from life as it unfolds. So those kind of those are the different kind of spiritual qualities that we can develop. You know, it's not always kind of said about sitting, about developing samadhi, although samadhi is, you know, is very helpful in many aspects of the path. That's just not about that. It's the path, and that's why I find the practice so much more interesting, because there's so much different variation, different parts that, you know, kind of come together, and they come together in a very organic way. And that's why it's good for us as a practitioner to be aware of the different things, aware of the different situation that's happening around us, aware of where you're at and where other people are at. Yeah. And then you find that, the more you kind of flow through life, flow through communal life, communal living, the path, you know, the spiritual qualities, the spiritual perfection start to kind of strengthen. They start to snowball, and they come together in ways that very beautiful ways that you don't expect. And you have, and then your faith, confidence in the Dhamma and the practice starts to grow naturally, not from a sense of self, not because when you read in the book, but just see wholesome states start to increase, and unwholesome states, anxieties and worries you have that were used to obsess with your mind, starts to fall away. You don't notice that fear. All those things start to kind of fall away from the mind naturally. Not because you wish them away, not because you rationalize them away, but they're just not there anymore. Or if they are there, they don't cause you as much suffering as they did before. And these are the fruits of the practice. These are fruits of, it happens in a natural, organic way. Not in, how we plan them, not according to our agendas and wish, but according to causes and conditions. So tonight, those are the kind of spirit, I don't know whether I name all 10 spiritual qualities, but you start out with sila, vadana, which is generosity, and then harmlessness, and then patient, endurance, and then there is renunciation, living simplicity, renouncing confusion, and then there's panya, wisdom. And there is also loving kindness, gentle, it's part of using our speech correctly, caring. And also this idea of equanimity is also being even, not too caught up. Yeah. And those and that's what the practice is about. It's always about many different aspects of life. So it's not always about sitting formal practice of washing the breath, but that's how we act throughout the day. It's the integral part of when we sit down, because it's the same mind. We let the mind drift a while, we indulge in irritation and anger, fault finding. And when you sit down, it's the same thing. So we're working with the mind, we're working with mindfulness throughout the day. And when you sit down, you'll find that the mind has a clarity. It's just, kind of have a focus, have an energy in it naturally already. Because you've been kind of watching the mind, training it, you've been, you know, kind of letting go of unwholesome states. You've been maintaining the wholesome states in the mind throughout the day. Yeah? So those are the 10 spiritual perfections that offer you to kind of strengthen your practice, not just in sitting meditation, but throughout the whole day. And maybe it causes a condition for much happiness for yourself and the world around you.
Andamayam ovada dhammakataya sadhu karam dadamasi.